Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Friday, April 21st. It's another Friday in America when, if you're black and minding your own business, you don't know if some white person will think you're going to hurt them and shoot you. You've probably heard by now that that's what happened to 16-year-old Ralph Yarl, an honor student, no less, in Kansas City, Missouri, after he rang the doorbell of the wrong house by mistake as he attempted to pick up his brother to drive him home. Yarl reportedly thought he was at an address on Northeast 115th Terrace, but he was really one block over on Northeast 115th Street. Now, it probably doesn't make it any better that the white guy who fired the gun acted alone and has been criminally charged, because what's the definition of acted alone? The shooter's grandson described him as, quote, down the right-wing rabbit hole, fully buying into the Fox News OAN kind of line, a 24-hour news cycle of fear and paranoia, unquote. A column in the Kansas City Star today argues that Fox News is complicit in the crime. And it probably doesn't make it any better that a 20-year-old white woman was also shot. She was killed, also after driving accidentally to the wrong house. That was in Hebron, New York, north of Albany the other day. A New York Times headline today says, in a nation armed to the teeth, these tiny missteps led to tragedy. Missteps, plural. But we know these kinds of horrors are not distributed evenly by race. And with us now, Princeton Professor of African American Studies, Imani Perry. She is author of the 2019 book that is sadly relevant to this moment called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. And she has an article in The Atlantic now following the Ralph Yarl shooting called This Country Will Break Our Hearts Again. Professor Perry was last on this show last year for her most recent book, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon Line to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Professor Perry, thanks for coming on again, and I'm sorry it's under these circumstances, of course, but welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess the point of your article is that, in a way, it's always under these circumstances, whether it's the immediate aftermath of an incident like the shooting of Ralph Yarl or not, right?
Absolutely. It's always under these circumstances, and I really appreciated your introduction, because these circumstances are, as you said, you know, unequally distributed, perhaps, but tragedies for all of us, which it, in and of itself is instructive. You know, my heart broke for the young woman. I think she was 20. I think her name was Kaylin Gillis in Hebron. And, it's extraordinary that we allow a minority, but a critical mass of our country to allow the circumstance where our young people have to think about the prospect of death at every turn. Horrifying.
In this particular case, the Ralph Yarl case, the shooter, Andrew Lester, is 84, and as an individual is described by his grandson in the Kansas City Star, as I mentioned, as down the rabbit hole of right-wing Fox News conspiracy theories. And some people speculate, well, he's 84, we don't know the condition of his mind. I think that's actually unfair to most 84-year-olds.
It really is. Yes.
But do those things make it more of an individual crime for which only he is responsible, or less of one, maybe?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a collective, because, you know, you cannot, the reality is that we have a social order in which people are socialized to be extremely selfish. We have an intensely anti-intellectual moment in history. We do have the Fox News rabbit hole, but we also have where our society is proliferated with guns. It's a storm. And we all have a responsibility for, you know, particularly those of us who are voting age, to respond to this storm. So sure, you know, there's lots of moments where people are ornery and hostile. There was a viral video of someone being angry about a baby crying on the plane the other day. Mm. But we live in a society where those moments of anger can actually convert into absolute tragedy so easily. And that's because we are we have people saying, well, it's your right to shoot somebody who actually who irritates you and who is on your quote, your property, or it's absolutely fine to have a stockpile of weapons for no particular reason besides your sort of fantastical imagining that someone might charge into your house and do something to you. It is absolutely more a collective issue. And I think that's really important because it may be the case that this individual is held responsible, but the reality is that this will happen again and again until we start to decide that we're going to change this situation, right?
Yeah.
And the idea is that we don't want children shot, and in some circumstances, thank God he survived, but, you know, or killed. Not just that we want a quote-unquote remedy, we want it not to happen in the first place.
And of course, you can't legally shoot somebody on your property because they irritate you, to use the word you used
right.
a minute ago. But some commentators are talking about stand-your-ground laws, such
yes.
as protected George Zimmerman, who killed Trayvon Martin back in 2012, stand-your-ground laws with an expanded definition of self-defense. And Missouri
yes.
officials haven't even ruled out that stand your ground might be used as a defense in court by Andrew Lester in the shooting of Ralph Jarl. Now, you're not a law professor, but do you have thoughts on where stand your ground laws or the mentality that it derives from and then in turn promotes might come in?
Yes, and I used to be a law professor, although
oh, I
wasn't
know
a career. Yeah, for 7 years, I started my career in legal academia, but I was not a crim professor, so I'll say this with a little bit of caution. But whether we're talking about expanded stand your ground laws or actually the logic of self-defense generally, that one of the challenges is that the interpretation of self-defense, whether it's sort of expanded interpretation, legally speaking, or the exercise of discretion where people are on a jury are interpreting self-defense, or even, you know, in circumstances where there's a judge, that racial ideologies often come into play in those moments of interpretation, and they hinge upon the idea of sort of the reasonable experience of fear. And that's part of the impact of a racially unjust society and racially bigoted discourses, is that oftentimes people think that fear is legitimated when it's not. I mean, his mischaracterization of Ralph Jarl as 6 feet tall, and, you know, and if grabbing the door, when, you know, and, you know, you saw that I broke down when I saw the photograph of him in the hospital bed, because he's still so narrow and slender and clearly a baby, and he's 5'8", and even if he was 6 feet tall, it wouldn't matter. But that misinterpretation, we know, is common. There's lots of research on how Black children are adultified. They're misperceived as being older and bigger than they are.
Some of the most infamous incidents of the last decade, that was a factor in the Michael Brown shooting, where they saw
yes.
him as being so big. That was a factor in the killing of 12-year-old Tamir Rice,
yes.
who was adultified yes. by the police.
Absolutely. So even, you know, so we do have to think about, there's the issue of the law, but there's also the issue of the racial ideology and discourses that shape how people interpret the law, who make decisions about what does or doesn't happen to those who act violently.
These attacks are making mainstream news. The killers are at least more often being charged with murder, unlike George Zimmerman, who killed Trayvon Martin, or the cops who killed Michael Brown or Eric Garner back then. And yet, as you say, these things keep happening. And in your article, you reference Sisyphus from Greek mythology.
Yes.
Would you make
yeah.
that analogy for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I remember at a moment when that was the most ready analogy that came, as sort of the Sisyphean, you know, Sisyphus keeps rolling the boulder up the hill, and it rolls down, and he's charged. This is his punishment. The boulder rolls down the hill, and he walks back down, and then he rolls it back up again, and then it goes down again. But really, this feels so much worse, because it is devastating. It's a cycle. It's dizzying. We actually take a range of actions and expend energy in a variety of ways, and we experience trauma and grief in each instance. I think, even the fact that part of the grief of this moment is that the child had to go to 3 houses before he got help. So there's the shooter, but then there is whatever produces a response to a shot child that you would not immediately say, I must help this child, is part of the problem too. And so, it's worse than Sisyphean. It's dizzying. It's, it's devastating.
And so the line of the article that the title is drawn from, we know that all the awareness and outrage in the world hasn't changed things. Our need for action is a sorrowful distraction from the reality that even after the trial of the man charged in Ralph's shooting has run its course, if there is a trial, this country will break our hearts again. And I'm curious, before we take some phone calls, where that leaves you personally or politically, if your faith in progress towards safety and equality keep getting reduced, because people will point to a big historical picture as they see it and say, slavery was abolished eventually, Jim Crow was abolished eventually. It would be wrong to be too cynical about the idea of progress, even with all the awfulness that persists so persistently. So,
right. I mean, I think immediately of James Baldwin's sentence, how long do you want for your progress? This is too slow. And it's slow, and it's happening simultaneous to an intensity of backlash. There's a relitigation that's happening of the 1960s. And we see that with respect to reproductive rights. We see that with respect to the attack on LGBTQIA people, and particularly trans children. And we see that with the hostility to African-American history. Across the board. So we're not just dealing with slow progress on one side. We're dealing with a rapid erosion of rights and access that people died for 50 years ago or 60 years ago, right? And so I'm not an organizer. I'm an intellectual, although I think, I have a responsibility to be involved in movement. For me, the point of writing the piece is to say, look, we have to engage in some kind of course shift. The strategy has to shift. I don't know what it is, but in some ways, it's sort of this open hands open, saying, what are we going to do now? Because the way what we've been doing is not working.
Tara in Ocean County, New Jersey. You're on WNYC, not that far from Princeton, where Imani Perry is a professor. Hi, Tara. You're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. What I was telling your screener, and then hopefully I can say again, is that it's just, as someone who grew up in school when the Columbine shooting happened and going through the fear of that, was in college when Virginia Tech happened, and now raising children of my own, it's just like, it's hard to not like just feel hopeless. It feels like depression and hopelessness is an appropriate response to the state of things right now. Things seem to be getting worse. And, planning trips to the grocery store to go when it's not crowded, when you go to a festival trying to think, okay, what if something happens, where are we going to meet up? Like, you take these kids, I'll take these kids, don't look for us, we'll meet over here. And like, it's just like living like this is just, it's so like heavy and exhausting. It feels like it's just permeated so much of life, and it feels like it's getting worse. It's not getting better. It feels worse. And I just don't see any hope of it getting better.
And I can hear or see or envision at least from this end of the microphone, so many young parents like yourself nodding their heads in sad agreement right now. Professor Perry, I don't know what the response to Tara is.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's comfort or just, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just appreciate so much that what Tara testified to, because she spoke to, I think, what is an overwhelming feeling. And the reality is also that it's so unfair, because this is what it means to have made a response have to be private, right? So individuals have to sort of imagine what they would do under impossible circumstances, because our democracy is not functioning on these issues, right? These should not be things that individuals have to figure out how to resolve. Our elected representatives, our community-based organizations should be able to represent the interests of what are legitimately the majority of Americans who think this is not how we should have to live, and we should have some reasonable, commonsensical limitations on people's capacities to wreak havoc. It's so profoundly unfair. That we have to try to figure this out on our own. And I say at the end of the piece, I'm trying and talk about wishing, watching my 16-year-old drive and wishing I could hold him, to my chest again in the baby Bjorn, and then realizing, but what would that do? I'm not any safer than he is. I mean, we're all vulnerable, every last one of us.
David in Middlesex County in Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm all right, Brian? Under the circumstances. Thank you for calling in.
So, yeah, the professor is extremely articulate, and she's really putting down some serious knowledge. I'm black, and I'm also a former CIA employee. I worked in Washington for about 16 years. Been all over the United States, been to South America, seen a lot of stuff. I think since the 45th president got into office, before he got into office, he riled up a lot of white males who are angry about, I don't know if they're losing their jobs, or they think, minorities are taking over the country. But what they failed to realize, my mom had a master's in education. My mom taught for 35 years in Newark. Black people basically, we raised, during slavery, we raised white people's kids. We picked all the food. Asian people laid the railroads. There wouldn't even be a United States without minorities. So why white men in particular are getting all bent out of shape, because minorities, so many minorities from India and this and that. I'm like, what is wrong with you? Nobody's threatening you. Nobody's bothering you. But the gun situation, that's just a long, long issue. And the problem is that there's too many mentally unstable people and angry people with guns. That's the basic problem. So I think psych profiles, every state, before you buy a gun, you need to get a psych profile. Hands, bottom line, bar none. Because there's too many lunatics shooting people, like the girls in Texas. I just told your screener, the girls in Texas, the cheerleaders got shot. It's this was a crazy week, and it's just getting crazier. And it's just, I don't know what to do. So that's my thought.
Yeah.
So thanks,
David,
guys.
Thank you. Call us again. Yeah, I mean, and Professor Perry, he brings up the psych profile, as he calls it, but also the sociological profile of what happened around the time that 45, as he called him, meaning Donald Trump, was running for office and in office. And I guess, I mean, I haven't seen exact polling. Maybe you know it. But we do seem to live in an age where, despite the objective facts on the ground, white people might feel as aggrieved as black people on racial grounds.
Yeah. I mean, I think that although, that's not the first time, right? I mean, you can go back to right after the Civil War, you have lawsuits in which people are saying, black people need to stop being the special favorites of the
right.
law, right?
Right.
In the thick of the birth of Jim Crow. I mean, I think
That was an argument against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, right? That was going to confer special rights.
Special rights, yeah. And I, you know, the reality is that it is about the way in which people, white people, can be manipulated with a sense of fear that they will lose their relative advantage and therefore feel even more vulnerable, in some ways a displacement of the anxiety and vulnerability in a society that actually fails to adequately protect all of its citizens, a displacement of that fear onto people who were below them as opposed to above, let's say it that way, right? Onto people who have been historically marginalized. Well, if everything is equal, then my status drops, right, is the fear. And that's what it is. I do think that the thing about the psychological element, though, in some ways it's predicated on, I think, a myth that that the majority of us are all well, and that there's a small number of people who are psychologically unhealthy. But if we are in a society that is profoundly unhealthy in so many ways, we all actually are vulnerable psychologically, particularly in the midst of the aftermath of COVID, and it, as a consequence of all of this death and the hyper media landscape where people are connected to phones 24/7 and we're filled with all kinds of chemicals. And so all of us actually are at risk of making poor decisions when we have deadly weapons in our hands. And I think we have to acknowledge that and to think about our collective well-being given our collective lack of healthfulness as a society.
Before you go, I said to the audience before that we would include at least one thought on the lighter side from your article. And that is that you wrote that you love teenagers, and that's part of why you teach college students. Not everyone says they love teenagers. Why do you?
Yeah. Oh, because, you know, they're amazing because they're so smart and they're so curious, but they're also so goofy and they make terrible decisions. I mean, it's sort of like the perfect storm of humanity. They're babies. They're the wisest, you know, they're goofy. And I think it's important, though, to keep that in mind, to have a tender heart to that age. We have these moments and then people start evaluating. I mean, this question of whether or not he held the door, my goodness, right? And I believe Ralph Jarl that he did not. But I just am sort of astounded at the conversation we can have so easily that moves us away from the reality of how magnificently messy teenagers are. We have to remember our tenderness in these moments, that should be part of our political and social analyses. So, yeah, love them. Love the kids.
They're babies and they're wise.
Yes.
And with that, we leave it with Princeton Professor of African American Studies, Imani Perry. She is author of the 2019 book that is sadly relevant to the conversation we've been having today called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. And she has an article in The Atlantic now following the Ralph Jarl shooting called This Country Will Break Our Hearts Again. Professor Perry, we really appreciate you coming on today for this.
Thank you so much for the conversation, Brad.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.